Welcome to Family Health by Mini First Aid. Mini First Aid are the UK's leading family first aid provider, and we are delighted to bring our latest podcast series to you, giving you all the information that you need around family health subjects. Thanks for joining. Series 1 of Family Health by Mini First Aid podcast is sponsored by Savlon Scar Prevention Gel. Savlon Scar Prevention Gel helps soothe pain, promote faster healing, as well as reducing the risk of scarring when used on minor wounds, superficial burns, and grazes. With 6 children in my house, scrapes and cuts are plentiful, so my first aid box saviour is Savlon Scar Prevention Gel. Hello, I'm Kate Ball, founder of Mini First Aid. Welcome to our podcast, Family Health by Mini First Aid. Now, it's great to hear that you've been enjoying our new Family Health podcast series, and we will continue to bring you top family health advice from leading experts. Today, I am delighted to introduce our guests, Sue Bozeman and Ken Dunn, joining us on behalf of Children's Burns Trust. Sue is an advanced nurse practitioner and Ken is a retired burns surgeon, so they have an absolute wealth of experience between them. Welcome to the show, both Sue and Ken.
Thank you, Kate. Hello, my name's Sue. So I work in our regional burns unit. I've been looking after adults and children with burn injuries for more than 25 years now.
Brilliant. And welcome, Ken.
Hello there. Very glad of you to invite me along today. I'm indeed a retired burns and plastic surgeon from Manchester, where I was a consultant for about 25 years. And have been involved with data around burn injury for that period of time and indeed longer. And I'm now a trustee with the Children's Burn Trust, who I support with information and other projects pertaining to burn injury prevention.
Brilliant. Thanks, guys. It's great to meet you both. Today, we've invited you to chat about burns, and we know from our first aid work that burns are, sadly, incredibly common, especially in the home. And we've got lots of literature available on our website, and we teach about preventing burns as well as the first aid treatment required for burns. And you can read lots more about that in the mini first aid blogs. But the aim of today is to think about how burns affect people longer term, the complications of infection, lifelong scarring, and perhaps the emotional effect on families, because a burn is for life, isn't it? And Sue, you can probably tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely, Kate. So if a person has quite a big burn, then it is really a lifelong thing. The initial treatment is just a very small part of a huge amount of care that needs to go into looking after somebody. And the effects can go on for a very long time. That said, people do heal very nicely and very well from burns. But the impact on them emotionally, as you say, but also financially, having to come backwards and forwards to the hospital, coming for lots of consultant appointments afterwards, physio, all the scar management that goes into it, it really can last a lifetime.
So what's the immediate treatment that you need to give someone who's had a burn?
So really the first line is absolutely cool running water for about 20 minutes if you can manage it. 20 minutes is a really long time in a small child that's very wriggly, so any cooling is better than no cooling. But if you can manage it, up to 20 minutes of cool water, try not to make it too cold. Definitely no ice. If you can't do that, then just wet towels, anything that you can do to cool down the burn. Do try to remember to take the clothes off as quickly as possible as well, because that will help with the cooling and stop the clothes from being against the skin and keeping the skin warm. And then once you've done that, a little bit of cling film helps to keep you comfortable, stops infection. Depending on what's going on, whether there's any skin loss, as to whether you need to get some medical help. Certainly in a child, if there is skin loss, then absolutely they should be seen either at GP surgery, pharmacy, 111, or attend an emergency department, depending on how big the area is.
Right, it's that 20 minutes, isn't it? And I know when we teach it in our classes, people go, wow, 20 minutes is a long time. Babies are going to cry, right? I don't even know if an adult generally could honestly say, hand on heart, that when they've had a burn, even if it's a small burn, a superficial burn, that they've done that 20 minutes. But it's important, right? It's the important time scale, isn't it?
It's really important. That research shows that the 20 minutes will cool the burn down sufficiently to reduce the burning impact and therefore the burn that you get from it. But you're right, 20 minutes is a really, really long time. And sometimes patients, particularly children, can get very cold. So you do have to balance it. If they're getting very cold and shivery, then you need to remove them from the cooling and try another method, whether it be wet towels. But yes, any cooling is better than none at all. And actually, first aid is still relevant up to about 2 hours after the burn injury. So even if you can't do it right that second, as soon as you can, get that cooling on and it will still make a difference.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now, Ken, there are some frightening stats, especially about children's burns, aren't there? Can you tell us a little bit about the prevalence of burn injuries, particularly in children in the UK?
Yeah, certainly. To be honest, the figures are very concerning and have been for many years. Our estimates of emergency department attendances for burns in children in England and Wales would suggest there's about 110 such instances per day around the country. Now, admittedly, fortunately, most of those are quite minor and do in fact vary around different parts of the country very significantly. In urban areas, areas of social deprivation, the figures are significantly higher. But burns impact all parts of society and, of course, all ages. Having said that, children are disproportionately affected by burn injuries. The admissions to the 23 specialised burn services in England and Wales for children under 16 are about half of the overall admissions are for children. And about half of that, in other words, about a quarter of all burn admissions to those services are under the age of two.
Oh, gosh.
So largely because of their, you know, exploration phase of development, they're exploring their environment, usually in the home, and the areas where injuries tend to occur are, of course, the kitchen and the living room, most commonly. However, there is some good news in that of the most severe burns and deaths from burn injury in children, those have fallen quite steadily over the years. And the unfortunate fact is that the smaller burns remain very common. And that has not dropped nearly as much. So still a lot of work to do.
Lots to do. Right. Now, Sue, tell us a little bit more then about what you see in your unit, the most common causes of burns based on your experience.
So definitely the most common cause for us, as Ken says, is in children under the age of two, and that's scalding injuries, mostly from hot drinks, hot drink spills. We see these patients all day long, and as Ken says, it's because the little ones are exploring. They're always a little bit taller than you think, they're a bit faster than you think, and it can happen in front of your eyes in a busy household. So definitely the hot drink scalds, see an awful lot of those. The other thing in children we see quite a lot of is contact burns, where they perhaps reach up and touch the hob or hair straighteners that have been left on, irons. It's amazing how long surfaces stay hot for even after you've turned the appliance off, and they can still burn a small child quite significantly. So I'd say those are the two areas where we see most of our injuries in small people.
And from a statistic point of view, Ken, what do the statistics say about causes of burns? What do we know are the facts there?
It's essentially what Sue has said. When you get down to the numbers nationally, about 50% of the injuries admitted to the burn services are from scalds, from hot fluid spills of some sort or other, usually a beverage. And tea is by far the commonest, which is some research that was done a few years ago looking at the temperature of different beverages. Is no real surprise, because tea with a very small amount of boiling water rather than hot water, and with a small amount of milk rather than the cooling effect of more milk in coffee, for example, then the beverage stays hotter for longer and as a consequence can injure for far longer than you might expect. So those are the commonest ones amongst the spills. Fortunately, scalds from hot baths and hot water systems, they've they have fallen off somewhat over the years. And we like to think that that was part of some of the legislation that CVT and others contributed to with an MP, Mary Craig, back in 2010, trying to get legislation in where thermistor mixing valves were basically made obligatory for renovated and new houses. And of course, that takes a long time to feed in the overall system and stats. And of course, it's extremely difficult to prove why something hasn't happened as opposed to when things do happen. But certainly the numbers have fallen off somewhat. And as Sue said, contact burns, hot objects, 25% of the cases that we're talking about have been because of contact burns. Usually, from a numbers point of view, electric hobs, which are difficult to tell when they're hot, and oven doors, which is another common cause, as well as the ones that she mentioned, the hair straighteners, irons, and any of these hot objects, which they're not glowing, they're not that hot, but they're certainly hot enough to produce a contact burn.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm just pulling faces. If anyone's watching this on video, I'm pulling faces because I've got, out of my six children, four are quite little, and the exploring side of stuff is very much still a thing. And also the fact that so many of those burns that you've mentioned are things that are preventable. You know, these are things that actually could be prevented if some sort of, you know, some health, you know, some general sort of good safety practice was in place. I know that not all burns can be prevented, but it just doesn't bear thinking about, does it, particularly with hot drinks? Because, you know, I know that to get through parenting, I thrive and require intravenous virtually tea and coffee, but it's leaving that steaming cup of tea around or a handle and a small hand coming to pull it. Now, Sue, we talked about, and we know in our teaching that removing clothing from a burn is something that we get asked about a lot. So when someone hasn't experienced a burn before and they perhaps don't know what to expect, how do they safely remove clothing to get to the burn so that they can treat it?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because you often hear people say, oh, no, you mustn't remove the clothes because it might take the skin off with it. Well, actually, if you've got a burn where it's burnt deep enough to start disturbing the skin layer, then that's inevitable and it's going to happen anyway, although that's very scary. So just getting those clothes off as quickly as possible is really, really important. Obviously, be very careful. If somebody's got a burn to their, say, their chest, their top, and then you're pulling the jumper off over their head, you need to be careful about you don't transfer heat to their face. But really getting those clothes off as quickly as possible, even if you start the cooling process. So, for instance, you hop into the bath with them, into the shower with a child in your arms, and you start the cooling process, and then you start removing their clothing as quickly as possible, because leaving the clothing against their skin holds the heat against their skin and can deepen the burn. So really, we do need to get that clothing off as quickly as possible. And don't be scared. If the skin starts to blister or comes away, that is something that would have happened anyway because of the depth. The really important thing to remember is things like nappies. I've actually just seen a child today who had a burn to their chest, and the tea had rolled down and into their nappy area just at the top. They had a little gap, and they've got quite a little nasty burn around that area of their nappy area now. Although they did brilliant first aid and they hopped in the shower quite quickly, that was the bit that got the deeper burn because they didn't notice that the heat was there. And socks as well. Sometimes people concentrate on other areas that appear to be obviously burnt, but forget things like little feet, socks. If socks are on, they're still absorbing that heat through the fabric. So just remember to check all over and make sure there isn't any area that's been missed, and get stripped down and get those clothes off to just check.
I think that's fascinating about the nappies, because it's not something that you would naturally necessarily think of, but because nappies are so blooming absorbent that they're going to hold a lot of liquid, aren't they, and keep it in next to the skin. Now, you know, obviously when we've had a burn and we've removed clothing and we've done the 20 minutes under cold running water and we're proceeding to A&E with a burn, Ken, from a clinical side of stuff, tell us what you can expect. What happens in A&E with somebody that's been burnt?
Well, as you might imagine, it's highly variable because it depends on the size of the injury, the age of the individual. All these factors will impact on the triage that's taking place very soon after going through the door, as it were. And the triage is based on an assessment of likely severity impact on survivability. So they may require immediate care or can wait a little while or indeed can be sat in the waiting area if it's very minor until they've got time to be seen. Essentially, it's all about the assessment of the size of the burn at that stage. People often talk about the depth of the burn at that stage, but it's actually very difficult to assess depth immediately. So it's really about the size of the injury and whether other injuries have taken place for whatever reason as well. We have to think very much about inhalation injury of smoke and hot fluids or hot gases if circumstances suggest that may have happened, because that risk to the airway is probably the most important thing. And that's the sort of thing that would project a case be triaged straight into resource room where they'll be assessed in detail. Obviously, pain relief has got to be given as soon as possible via an appropriate route, usually oral for kids with minor injuries, of course, but also a first aid assessment to see whether, in fact, adequate first aid has already been provided. And if not, as you've heard, it can be useful for 2 to 3 hours after the event. So one could complete the first aid at that time if it was felt to be necessary. Then really it's a decision by the staff as to whether the individual can be treated locally or whether they have to be referred on to a burn service. Now, as I mentioned, there's only 23 burn services in England and Wales, so sometimes the transfer distances and times be quite lengthy, and obviously complex and severe injuries require a burn service, and fortunately they are relatively rare in children, but are still a significant number nationally. Because the transfers are long, and advice and experience is necessary, because A&E staff tend not to see that many major burns. It's estimated about one major burn every 6 months,
okay,
or a larger number of A&Es in the country. Then the use of a tele-referral system in parts of the country has proved to be very effective, particularly as it allows images to be transferred to the burn service so they can see what the wound actually looks like and can advise accordingly. About half of our A&Es have access to such a system at the moment, and that has been quite impressive from a numbers point of view, in that it's dropped the number of ambulance transfers by about half while the system's been in use over recent years. But it also allows burn service staff to make decisions or help the A&E staff make decisions about whether to transfer the burned individual immediately or whether in fact they can wait a day or two and then attend a clinic, an outpatient clinic or an outreach clinic, and be assessed at that time rather than in a sort of immediate transfer situation. And as Sue has mentioned, what they would typically do for such a transfer, if immediate, is to do a temporary cover of the burn with something like cling film and a bandage to keep it in place. And then transfer the individual. If it's going to be a clinic in a day or two, then they will dress the wound in such a way as to allow it to be sealed and protected.
Yep.
And then that will allow the burn service to see that individual, hopefully with the images of the original injury, and then compare the appearance of the wound at about 24, 48 hours.
Okay.
Now, so, if a decision is made to treat the burn locally, then that will usually be done either in an A&E clinic or may be transferred to a community team to continue doing dressings every couple of days, depending on circumstance.
So the burns are, well, we know there are different types of burns or different depths sometimes, or and sometimes known superficial, partial or full thickness. People listening at home might not know what those words mean or might not understand the difference. Can you tell us, Ken, when you're talking about
differences? I know you said sometimes it's hard to see initially what that difference is, but just if someone heard the word superficial, what are we referring to? What are we talking about?
To be honest, the confusion is fair, because the wording is not immediately apparent. In the UK and Europe, we tend to use superficial, partial thickness, dermal injury, or full thickness. In the Americas, they tend to use first, second, third, fourth degree descriptors, which I think are very difficult to follow to somebody who is not familiar. So I think the anatomic system that we use is perhaps easier to understand. And really, it all depends on the different levels of the skin that are affected by the burn injury. And to be honest, the thickness and composition of the skin in the body actually varies a huge amount around different parts of the body. And a classification system that was published years and years and years ago assessed that there was probably about 23 different combinations of skin around the body. It's got thicker epidermis, thicker dermis, more hair, less hair. All those sort of things impact on what a particular amount of burning will do to that skin. In general terms, the skin is only about 2.5 millimeters thick. So it's in most areas, and which is not a lot. So the sort of components of the skin are largely the dermis. That's actually the thickest bit, and that's relatively with free of cells, and that many cells in it. And it is really the support structure, it's the elastic structure of the skin. It allows the strength of the skin, whereas it's on top of it is the epidermis. And that's the cellular bit. That's the bit that provides the waterproofing and the protection against infection. And that is really a fraction of a millimeter thick. So it doesn't take a great deal to damage that. And the key feature of the burn is to appreciate that it develops over time. So what you see immediately, even following first aid, what you see immediately is not what you're going to get. What is probably the best time to assess a burn, which is about 48 hours afterwards, as to its depth.
Didn't know that. Right, okay. That's fascinating.
That's when you've got the best chance of visually assessing. There are other ways of assessing a burn. There's the laser Doppler systems and all sorts of mechanical ways of assessing it, perhaps more reliably, particularly for those not experienced at looking at burns. But 48 hours in is probably the best. So from very mild injuries, the epidermis may well just show a patch of redness, which is reassuring to most people. But the problem is it develops, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the redness just disappears after a few hours because it's very, very mild. But some of it, sometimes, quite frequently, that epidermal redness turns into blistering, which may not be immediate. But it develops over a few hours. And of course, if that patch then all sloughs off, if the epidermis all separates off, then that is very painful.
Sure.
And it also leaks a lot of fluid. So it's actually quite dramatic, but fortunately, they tend to heal quite well within a week or two, with sometimes minimal scarring, sometimes no scarring at all. But as it goes deeper into the skin, into the basal layer of the epidermis, where all the recovery tends to come from, and into the dermis, then the appearances of the wound are different. And of course, the treatment requirements are also different. As you go into the superficial dermis, that's a layer that is difficult to assess, but is also recoverable. But as you go further into the mid-dermis and the deep dermis, then less and less recoverable elements of epidermal cells are available to resurface the wound. So you will end up with worse scarring, slower healing, and an increased risk of needing skin grafting to get it healed in the first place. And then when you've lost all dermis, you're into a full thickness loss, which, unless it's very small, will require some form of grafting to get it healed, typically.
So that's your three levels or three types of burn. But let's talk then, Sue, about the burns and how they look, because our listeners may have different colour of skin. And sometimes they might only know or hear a description of what a burn looks like on white skin. So how do burns differ in what they look like?
So, yes, you're right. They can look very different on different skin colours. And the initial burn, when it occurs, as Ken said, can change dramatically. Most people mm-hmm. have a really good capacity to heal, particularly children. And a lot of children's burns will heal the first layer of skin within a couple of weeks, within 2 weeks or so. But at that point, the skin may look quite bright pink. And over time, it fades, it can fade down. But it very much depends on your pigments that you already have in your skin, so your colouring that you already have in your skin. And so, for instance, somebody who already has quite dark pigments, their initial burn can look very, very bright pink. And then as the burn heals and they get their new skin, it can look sometimes even darker pigment than they had before, or maybe slightly lighter pigment than they had before. Over time, that can change. The first initial healing may only take 2 to 4 weeks, but still the skin continues to change for approximately up to about 6 months, and then really up to 2 years for the skin cells to settle down completely and look at the point that they're going to look for forever, really. So scarring can vary dramatically depending on the skin type that you've got, but also your healing capacity. So, for instance, somebody who has diabetes perhaps might not heal as quickly as a young, healthy child who could heal up, you know, very quite quickly from a burn injury. So there's lots of things involved in it, but it's surprising the colours that your skin changes can go through before you get to your final result, really.
So how then, Ken, can infection affect burns or burns recovery?
Oh, well, profoundly, unfortunately. It's the one thing that burn staff try very, very hard to reduce and keep under control. It's really the key, I suppose, is to understand where the sources or the risks of infection occur.
Okay.
And it has to be said that in injuries that have taken place out of doors, particularly camping or things like that, then there's a very real contamination risk from the environment that the individual is in shortly after the injury, because the skin integrity is gone. This can occasionally be from the first aid fluids used with the best of intentions, because they are themselves contaminated. So, you know, as you know, generally speaking, clean domestic water supply, cool water, is our absolute preference. But because of circumstances, people may use natural water sources.
Sure.
And I think a general rule of thumb is, if you've got a choice, use one that's flowing rather than static.
Okay, that's good to know.
Because
okay,
static natural water, stagnant water, is generally teeming with bacteria and best avoided. If you're in a stream, then actually holding an individual upstream rather than where your feet are means you're not disturbing the mud. So you keep them away from the stuff that's coming off the stream bed. There's lots of sort of stuff that we have taught the armed forces for years and years about avoiding getting contamination of wounds of all sorts. By using natural water sources for decontamination.
That's fascinating. Now, if I'm treating a burn in my kitchen, so perhaps there's not so much of a contamination risk as such, and I need to transfer my child to hospital, what can I do to make sure that I keep that infection risk low or as low as possible?
Well, actually, the first aid with domestic water supply is a really good way of decontaminating the wound. It's diluting whatever is on the skin. The fact is that the vast majority of burn injury infections, they tend to occur in the days following the burn injury, and tend to be by bacteria from the person themselves, either from their skin or from their gut, and particularly in children from their noses and throats because they have a tendency to share excretions really quite freely. So they can contaminate the burn wound from their, those sources as well. So the key for burn service staff is to keep the burn wound contamination under control, and the growth of natural bacteria, normal bacteria, in under the dressing by removing the dressing, washing the wound regularly, and indeed applying dressings more frequently if they feel there is any real risk of infection developing. To try and keep a handle on that, they will often take swabs of the wound even though there is no apparent infection, because they'd like to know what bacteria are there now.
Sure.
Because they may cause a problem in a few days. And particular bacterial types are more dangerous than others, more common than others. And of course, if they become quite, get a hold on a wound, can of course be life-threatening by their very nature.
And I think, Ken, when you, what you were talking about there about the washing of the wounds, we were very privileged when Children's Burns Trust came to speak at our conference recently to hear from one of the wonderful Children's Burns Trust ambassadors, Michelle. And she shared her experience of being in the hospital and having her little boy's burns regularly washed. And the, I guess, the family trauma that they were going through with the ongoing treatment. Now, Sue, talk to me then about the emotional effects that a family experience following a bad burn for, you know, for parents, for carers, or someone with a family member. What's that emotional experience like for your families?
I mean, it's huge. I mean, as you say, we heard from Michelle how traumatic it can be for everybody, not just the child, but the whole family. You know, but there's often people carry huge amounts of guilt because often the burn has happened in the family home. You feel like it could have been avoided. It was an awful accident. Literally, sometimes it happens in front of your eyes and, you know, and your child ends up with an awful burn. So there's lots of people carry guilt. Sometimes they're in the care of their grandparents at the time that it happens. It just adds to the family dynamics. And then when they're in hospital, you feel, you know, I think often parents feel a bit helpless because their child is often in pain when they're having their wound care done and they can't take that pain away as much as they'd like to. And we use painkillers to try and help with that, but we can never stop the take away the pain completely. So the parents or the carers have to endure seeing their child being in pain a lot of the time. And, you know, and just the emotional aspect of trying to look after your child who's in hospital, but also maybe look after siblings at home, try and split yourself. You know, people are often having to be off work, and there's all the pressures and trauma that go with hoping that you've got a boss that's supportive, that you can be off work for a while to be with your child in hospital. Financially, it can be really scary, you know, because you're thinking, oh my goodness, I'm not working, I'm not earning money. Maybe you're having to travel backwards and forwards. Some of our patients have to travel maybe up to 2 hours to come to us for their burn care. And once they're discharged, even more, they still have to come back for wound care. That can have a huge financial impact, which can really, you know, people can really struggle. They then have to decide whether they want to, you know, pay to travel to come to hospital or feed their children sometimes. So there's a whole range of emotions that come with the package, and not just for the child who's going through the trauma, for the families, for the siblings that are at home worrying, scared, you know, where's their parents gone, where's their sibling gone. So, you know, it can really have quite a fundamental impact for a long period of time for people. Fortunately, we have an amazing psychotherapy service within most burns units who help and help support families. And, you know, sometimes it really helps just to talk to other people that have been through something similar or somebody that can support. But it's, you know, it really is quite fundamental in terms of the emotional impact.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it? And I think, guys, I think we could probably go on talking all day just about some of the incredible stories that you both know and the work of the Children's Burns Trust as well, and not just the education and burns prevention piece, but also in the piece of working and supporting those families that are dealing with managing burns care and the after treatment and the psychological impact of a burns injury, whether it's to themselves or to one of their loved ones. And so I think we need to have you back so that we can talk about it again. But I'm really keen just to ask you then, in summary, to both of you, first to you, Ken, for families listening today, what would you want their takeaway to be about burns education and just burns knowledge in general?
I think it's important to appreciate that burns can happen to anybody. Mm-hmm. This doesn't mean that, as Sue said, that people need to be guilty about it, but they need to accept that it is one of the facts of life that injuries will happen. Children are very difficult to control and will explore and unfortunately damage themselves doing all sorts of things that you would hope adults wouldn't. But it's important to understand, perhaps for families, to understand some of the risk factors, you know, the real areas of concern, so that we might all work towards preventing as many of these injuries as possible. Because, as you've said earlier, we will never prevent them all.
No.
But we can hopefully make a significant impact. And I suppose the other thing is that to appreciate that there is something useful and active they can do if a burn does occur.
Yeah, sure.
That with first aid and some of the advice that you and others give families to actively improve the outcome for their children is very important for people to appreciate.
Great, thank you. And what about you, Sue? What for you?
I think probably, you know, I think we all just need to slow down a little bit sometimes and actually stop and think, you know, take that second to close the stair gate, take that extra minute to put the cup of tea up a little bit higher. You know, sometimes we're very, you know, if a child's whinging and crying because they're hungry, we scoop them up in our arms and then we try and multitask and cook dinner whilst we're holding them. And actually, you know, just to let them cry for a few more minutes whilst you cook their tea can mean the difference between holding them getting a burn and them needing to cry for an awful lot longer for, you know, days. So you know, sometimes I think we all just need to, you know, slow down a little bit, take a breath and just take those extra steps to keep each other safe, but that actually recognize that yes, accidents happen, and sometimes they happen in front of your eyes, as Ken said, and they can't be avoided. But at that point, you know, big breath, be calm, do your first aid, and know that you could turn a big burn into a little burn just by doing the right first aid.
Guys, thank you so much. It's just wonderful to listen to you, and we could talk for ages. And thank you so much for sharing your insights with us. Thank you to our listeners for listening to Family Health by Mini First Aid. You've been listening to Sue Bozeman and Ken Dunn from Children's Burns Trust, who I'm sure will be back to join us on another series if they will accept the invitation. If you want to watch the video from today's conversations, our YouTube channel, Family Health for Mini First Aid, will allow you to watch the video of today's podcast. You can subscribe to all of our podcasts on your regular favourite podcast channels. And if you have a subject, a family health subject, that you would like me to chat to an industry expert about, then please do get in contact with Mini First Aid. We would love to provide more excellent interviews for you, giving you the information that you need for you and your family. So thank you to Sue and to Ken for joining me today. And we will see you all again very soon. Goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Family Health by Mini First Aid. I hope you found our podcast really useful and informative. If you want to know more about Mini First Aid classes, courses, qualification courses, or first aid supplies, please do visit minifirstaid.co.uk or look us up on all your favourite social platforms at Mini First Aid. I take Savlon Scar Prevention Gel everywhere with me so that I'm always prepared for the many little and sometimes bigger accidents that my kids encounter. Thank you again to Savlon Prevention Gel for sponsoring Series 1 of the Family Health by Mini First Aid podcast.